for the court today. And I think it probably appropriate to comment on standard for review at the outset of the discussion. The respondents believe that the issue is whether there's sufficient evidence in the record to support the decision that the administrative law judge made with regard to penalties. And the respondents also believe that the administrative law judge was correct in determining the claimant had to overcome the division independent medical exam by clear and convincing evidence. Claimant disagrees with both of these assertions. As to the first, if it's determined that there is an abuse of discretion by the administrative law judge in issuing a penalty of $100 in connection with the conduct of respondent's attorney below, then the appropriate standard would be obviously de novo. It is claimant's assertion that if the court reviews respondent's brief in this matter at page 22, I'm sorry, at page 6, respondents have set forth a three-pronged test to determine whether there is an abuse of discretion in regard to the administrative law judge's conduct. And in doing so, respondents' counsel states that it has to be shown or there has to be consideration of reprehensibility of the conduct, the disparity between harm caused by violation and penalty, and the difference between the penalty and civil damages that could be imposed in comparable cases. I'd like to first discuss those three criteria. But before I do, I want to briefly review what occurred in this case. In the workers' comp system, once an application for hearing is filed, if the party who files the application wants to cancel the hearing after the response to application is filed and issue is joined, then the party who filed the application has to actually confer, meet with, or speak with opposing counsel and secure opposing counsel's agreement that the hearing be vacated. And that's pursuant to Rule 15 in the workers' compensation process.
In this case, you had already filed an objection to the hearing going forward before that even happened, hadn't you?
I had filed a motion to strike the application that was filed by respondents. This was not claimant's application. So there was a denial of the motion by a workers' compensation judge. And then there was, subsequent to that time, claimant went ahead after respondents then changed their mind and decided to cancel the hearing unilaterally. Respondents went ahead and notified the Office of Administrative Courts in Colorado Springs that the hearing was to be vacated. And respondents counsel affirmatively checked a box affirming specifically that he had met with claimants counsel, me, had discussed the matter and had secured my agreement that the hearing be vacated.
And that counsel is no longer on the case, correct?
That's correct. In fact, that counsel ended up testifying in this matter.
Mr. Holmes, can we cut to the chase on this one? How is your client hurt at all here? I mean, basically, you pointed out that's a misstatement. You got the hearing. How is your client hurt in any way?
My client.
I guess what I'm asking, very frankly, why are we here over $100? It seems to be with all due respect, a pretty great waste of your resources, your client's money, both sides, and judicial resources. I don't get why we're here. Please.
With all due respect, I think the fact that the penalty was $100 is not just insulting, that the hallmarks of break in the process below. I think the fact that the judge only imposed a penalty of $100 is the problem. I think the fact that we are here at $100 is not the issue. I think what we're here for is the fact that a rule was created to assure that counsel would honestly report to the Office of Administrative Courts if they matter.
Yes, that's weird. Sorry about that.
If I change this rule.
I don't
know. We're really here because opposing counsel lied to the court below. We are really here because I'm asking this court to review behavior on the part of an attorney in the presence of a litigant to a workers' compensation claim in which respondent's attorney affirmatively represented to the office.
Mr. Mullins, well, let me go back.
Sure.
The At the time of the hearing, the statute said, quote, shall be punished by a fine of not more than $500 per day for each such offense. Is that correct?
That's right.
Now, that sounds on its face fairly discretionary.
It is.
And at the time, what record did you make as far as perhaps the value of the company compensating for expenses, those kinds of things? What record was made below on that issue?
The amount of time that was spent on attorney's time was known to the judge.
So you filed some kind of an affidavit indicating hours?
There was no opportunity given, and the standard in terms of the penalty with the attorney's fees are to be considered is that ordinary practices that subsequent to hearing an affidavit is permitted. But that's not my argument.
Okay.
That's clearly not my argument. If you take a look at Judge Stuber's first order in this case, he said there was no way that the prior attorney for respondents, there was no way that he could have reasonably asserted that he had secured claimant's attorney's permission or consent to cancel the hearing. And Judge Stuber made no bones about that, and there was no wiggle room within the statement. By the time we get to the second order, Judge Stuber forgave the conduct in essence by saying that respondent's counsel was confused. I respectfully submit to this court the page 388 and 389 of your record, lines 17 through 25 on 388 and lines 1 through 15 on 389, constituting respondent counsel's prior respondent counsel's testimony in cross-examination, leaves no doubt but that respondent's counsel asserted that once he wrote a letter to claimant's counsel and did not receive a response, as far as he was concerned, he had secured the actual permission of claimant's counsel in order to strike the hearing.
So it sounds like he misunderstood.
No, there's no confusion about misunderstanding according to Judge Stuber's prior order, because Judge Stuber found, as a matter of fact, in the first order, prior to the remand, that there's no way that that attorney could have reached that assumption. And part of Judge Stuber's finding in that regard is premised upon the testimony before Judge Stuber, in which respondent's counsel, when asked about his relationship with claimant's counsel, engaged in conduct and descriptive terms that this court is already aware of, and I'm not going to repeat.
Thank you.
Just for the sensationalism. But Judge Stuber's initial comment was correct, and Judge Stuber's initial comment cannot be reconciled with Judge Stuber's subsequent order, in which he characterized respondent's counsel as being confused. And those two assertions are mutually exclusive. It is claimant's position in this matter that it is not the issue that the judge awarded $100, so why am I bothering this court? It is claimant's assertion that justice was not served in this case.
At the time, did you request the maximum penalty of $500 per day?
I did. Not only did I request the maximum penalty, I requested that the penalty run from October 23rd, 2008, if you look at page 84 in the record, from October 23rd, 2008 through November 4, 2008.
And that's pointed out in your brief before us? Those record citations?
I believe it is. The page 84 is the motion to retain the matter on the record. Once there was a notice that the case was going to be vacated. And what respondent's counsel did in response to claimant's motion to specifically retain the case on the record, after respondent's counsel misled the Office of Administrative Courts, what respondent's counsel did was to write a four-page opposition to claimant's motion, and that's found starting at page 79 of the record. And Judge Stuber finally issued a formal order on November 4, 2008, in which Judge Stuber specifically ordered that the matter would be retained on the record. So we have the initial misrepresentation followed by claimant's conduct in asserting that this matter never was the subject of an agreement, followed by a clerk restoration of the case to the hearing docket, followed by claimant's attorney spending the time to prepare and file the motion to retain, followed by the respondent's counsel filing a four-page opposition motion, or a four-page opposition statement in response to the motion, followed by Judge Stuber's order, finally ordering that the matter absolutely be retained. What are claimant's damages? Claimant did not know what the outcome of the motion practice was going to be in order to secure her right to appear in court. Claimant experienced attorneys, potential attorney's fees for a good number of hours in having to deal with the issue, both with regard to contacting the clerk, preparing the motion, appearing in court on the issue, subsequently dealing with the appeal of Judge Stuber's order that refused any penalty, processing the brief on appeal, and then once the matter was remanded, reviewing Judge Stuber's order, and here we are. There's been a significant amount of legal time spent on an issue that was valid. There's been a significant amount of attorney's time spent correcting and rectifying the conduct or remediating the conduct of respondent's counsel that was intentional. The other, and I respectfully submit that the standards suggested by respondent's counsel as to disparity between the harm caused by the violation and the penalty should be self-evident in terms of the amount of attorney's time that this court is mindful of, in terms of time required to prepare and file and argue these motions. The reprehensibility of the conduct, based on Judge Stuber's first order in this case, respondents' counsel lied to the Office of Administrative Courts. I know this court does not like that term being used, but the plain, simple fact of the matter is, that's what happened. And as to the third problem that respondents argue about the difference between the penalty and civil damages that could be imposed, I think the comment, the lead comment, Your Honor, that Judge Gabriel made is really highlights what the hamstring result is for the claimant who's subject to this kind of tomfoolery. It's dishonest conduct that results in the claimant believing that the lawyer got a break and got a deal because of the relationship between the court and the attorneys. It shouldn't be tolerated. The second issue has to do with the Dime report and the opinion of the Dime position. The Dime position in this case specifically stated in examination at hearing that she had no idea when she performed her examination that there was a demonstration that the claimant had a torn rotator cuff in her shoulder.
Did she ever change her ultimate opinion?
Yes, she did. In fact, what she said to the court was, as noted in the claimant's brief, if I can have just a second. What she said to the court was that in light of the evidence that's demonstrated by the MRI that was done subsequent to her evaluation, that there was no question but that the work injury and the overuse contributed to the tear. And
she didn't opine that it was ultimately routine wear and tear and not overcompensation.
She actually gave five or six different opinions, some of them at the encouragement of the judge, of the administrative law judge, but she did not rescind or retract the opinion that I just iterated that is found in claim.
Did she rescind that, what I just stated?
She didn't rescind any of them. But my point is, under the law, once there is this combination of opinions expressed where the dying doctor is effectively all over the place, as this one was, the net result, according to the applicable law, is that the dying opinion is neutralized, and the burden of proof is no longer clear and convincing.
What case supports that? I think you say, was it Faulkner, if I have the name right?
I'm sorry.
I think you cited maybe Faulkner. I'm trying to figure out what's your best case on this point, because I guess my problem, the case you cited, I think it was Faulkner, there was compensability was directly at issue. And so I'm trying to figure out what case supports your position where there's, even if assuming you're right for argument's sake, that the dime physician's all over the map. We then go to some, we basically treat it as if there was no dime opinion. That seems to be your position.
It is our position.
Okay, so I'm trying to figure out what case law supports that. And
bear with me just
please, of course.
No, Honor, I can't put my finger on it at this second. I can certainly submit that post-argument if you want me to.
I assume it's in your brief, whatever you're...
I believe so, and I assert to the court that that clearly is the law in Colorado, that once the Don Doctor has expressed an opinion that is mutually exclusive or is expressed in both directions, the opinion is therefore neutralized, and that clear and convincing no longer applies. And in this case, if you apply rules with regard to scientific and medical reliability to this dying doctor's opinion in her written report and in her testimony can't be relied upon, I don't think, in either direction for anything of substance, because she clearly did not know what the claimant's condition was at the time she performed the dime or wrote the dime report.
Smalls, I'm afraid your time is up. If there is such a case, it'll be cited in your brief, correct?
I believe so. If you'll give me a couple of days to submit, and if that we fail to do that, I would appreciate that.
If it's in the brief, we'll find it. Thank you.
Okay.
Counsel?
May it please the court, my name is Paul Krueger, attorney number 34592, representing the employer. Obviously, there are two cases consolidated. I'll discuss the penalty case first. In Associated Business Products versus the Industrial Claim Appeals Office, a division of this court held that the amount of a penalty is reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard. Here, in the present case, the appellant is not asserting that administrative law judge misstated the law or misapplied the law. It's not my understanding upon review of the brief or argument here today that the judge's findings of fact aren't supported by evidence in the record. Listening today, it's my understanding that the argument is simply that the penalty amount should have been higher. That under an abuse of discretion standard, the ALJ's order should be upheld in and of itself. The administrative law judge made very detailed findings with regards to the conduct of the attorney in this case. He specifically found that the attorney misunderstood his obligation. Now, he did use the term that it was an unreasonable mistake, and that has to be put into context because...
That was the second order, correct?
Yes, in the second order. Because in 843.304, when you impose a penalty in the Workers' Compensation Act, there can be a violation of a rule or order or a statute even. And if it's unreasonable, if it's reasonable, then no penalty would be imposed. So to impose a penalty, the violation must be unreasonable. So he did find, in the second order, that the counsel's canceling of the hearing without an affirmative agreement from opposing counsel was an unreasonable violation. Well, that established the basis for the penalty. Then he discussed the reprehensibility of the conduct, the prejudice to the claimant, and deterrence. Very, very specifically, he did. And with regards to the conduct, that's when he made the determination, based upon his review of the evidence and the attorney's testimony, that it was he misunderstood his obligation. With
Mr. Krueger, sorry to interrupt. I'll ask you the same question I asked Mr. Mullins. In looking at what was argued below, what's your understanding of the record?
My understanding of the record is that to the extent that claimant's counsel is now arguing that his attorney fees should have been considered, the size and scope of the employer should have been considered, that evidence was not presented in front of the administrative law judge for purposes of...
And so what position was taken below?
By which party?
By claimant.
Well, they did ask for $500 a day.
$500 a day?
Yes.
And what else did they ask?
For 14 days,
okay.
I believe.
And the principal base in the record was this conduct is reprehensible and you need to punish this person. Maybe that's what Judge Furman is getting at. At least I'm curious in that. What's the evidence the judge was relying on here? Besides, I understand on the face of it, Mr. Mullen's position was the conduct was reprehensible and I don't think we need any more than here's what happened. Was there anything else submitted to the ALJ in support of the penalty?
Not really. That was basically it. It was the testimony of the claimant. There's the testimony of the claimant, the testimony of the attorney, as far as costs incurred, affidavits of costs, things along those lines. Those weren't submitted to the administrative law judge.
Were you representing employer at the time?
I was not. My law firm was, but I was not.
Okay.
So at this particular, so at that stage, the administrative law judge made a determination of the conduct, said it was unreasonable. However, it was a misunderstanding. In order to deter this in the future, I think $100 is sufficient. And there was no real prejudice to the claimant because the hearing was immediately put back on the docket and it took place on that day. Consequently, there was no substantial harm or no harm to the claimant in this particular case. And so the ALJ, the administrative law judge, determined after hearing all of that, and he knew, obviously, that the case had been remanded from the ICAO. He determined that $100 was sufficient.
Is that $100?
It could have been 1 cent. It literally, it is 1 cent.
I understand.
$100. And so here, the administrative law judge determined that that was sufficient conduct based on a misunderstanding of the obligations of the attorney in this case.
A glaring misunderstanding.
Might very well be, Your Honor, but the administrative law judge was in the very best position to make a determination, being presented with both sides and being there in the courtroom to make that determination. And that's why we have an abuse of discretion standard with regards to these penalty amounts, because the trier...
On its face, doesn't it seem that $100 is not really a deterrent?
Oh, I don't believe so, Your Honor, because the deterrent goes, I mean, $100 shows that there was a penalty. I mean, there was a penalty. That's going to be on the record in that case. That in and of itself is, quite frankly, a black mark.
Saying this is a public censure, right?
In some respects. I mean, considering the top end is $500 and the bottom end is 1 cent.
Per day.
And the administrative law judge made the determination that, well, this was a one-time violation. The one day it happened was the day that they canceled. That was the day they violated the orders, when they canceled the hearing without agreement. So it was a one-day violation. It wasn't a situation where, for example, benefits were unilaterally terminated for an extensive period of time.
The motion to reschedule a hearing was filed the very next day after the motion to cancel the hearing. It was only one day between the period of time. That's what you're saying.
Right.
That's where he came up with the one day. He came up with the one day, apparently.
That's correct. It was immediately put back on the docket.
I'm just trying to figure out what the evidence was here in front of the judge, the ALJ. The ALJ, I think, also considered the fact that counsel had what I think was a very unfortunate dysfunctional relationship. That's something also the court considered. Am I right that that's something the ALJ considered?
Yeah, I think it's a CD1, page 289 to 90, R's findings of fact. And he does reference the dysfunctional relationship between these two attorneys, and there was much discussion during the testimony of relationship that they didn't get along well, and that perhaps led to not making the phone call that two attorneys who get along with would make. And from that perspective, and the judge also made a determination that from time to time one party believes an agreement exists to cancel a hearing when in fact the opposing party does not agree. So I think ALJ Stuber understands there are situations where there are misunderstandings, and it happens, and in this case it was correctly and swiftly rectified. So consequently, he felt $100 was sufficient.
And he had sent, the counsel had sent a fax to the counsel for the claimant saying, I'm going to cancel the hearing. He just had gotten no response to it. 6 or 7 days had gone by and he got no response.
That's correct.
From which you may have inferred that there's no objection to it, although he had not specifically conferred with him. He did at least attempt to communicate with them. He didn't file unilaterally a statement saying this hearing's off.
No, and that's exactly, Your Honor. And that was the evidence submitted. Like, with regards to a motion, you have to confer with opposing counsel. So often people leave a voicemail or write a letter or send a fax from that perspective. However, with regards to an opposing counsel's correct, with regards to OAC 15, there has to be an affirmative agreement. That was the misunderstanding that counsel made, was that, well, I thought I was conferring by doing this, and that was the rule that was violated, and fair enough. We're not challenging that, and it's simply the $100 was sufficient in this case.
Mr. Kruger, can I turn our attention to the dime issue? I want to take, and I know you disagree with Mr. Mullins' position on the facts, but let's assume, for purpose of my question, Mr. Mullins is right, that we conclude the dime physician's all over the map. She's kind of changed her views, inconsistent, whatever else. In that situation, what would the standard be? Are we still at a clear and convincing standard or something else?
Absolutely. And I focus your attention on Andrade versus the Industrial Claim Appeals Office. That is a published opinion from a division of this court whereby a dying physician rendered one opinion, then during a subsequent testimony was shown video surveillance and changed their opinion. And it was up then at that point when a dying physician has conflicting opinions, it's up to the administrative law judge to first determine what is the true opinion of the dying physician. And this court held that an ALJ could rely upon subsequent testimony from a dying physician when determining what the true opinion is, what the true diagnosis is. And that in that situation, the clear and convincing standard would still apply. That's exactly what happened here. You know, I don't think there's any dispute. There is some, in the claimant's brief, there is some discussion that there's the preponderance of the evidence standard here versus clear and convincing. And I think it's very important to make a distinction in workers' compensation between compensability and causation. In this case, there was compensability. At the time of this hearing, there was a compensable workers' compensation injury. The claimant had been receiving benefits. What was at issue was causation of her right shoulder conditions. It's well established, and this court held in Cordova versus ICAO, cited in respondent's brief, that the issue of causation with regards to various body parts when a dying physician is considering MMI and impairment, maximum medical improvement and impairment, is entitled to the clear and convincing evidence standard. So while the statute, when you read 842.107.8, the dying physician statute, it talks about maximum medical improvement and impairment being this heightened standard, clear and convincing evidence. Well, in this case, we are talking about maximum medical improvement, but within that is causation. In other words, what caused the claimant's right shoulder injury? If the right shoulder injury was not caused by the compensable incident, she was at MMI. If it was caused by the compensable incident, then she would not be at MMI. It's intertwined. You just can't get away from it. And so that's why this court in Cordova said causation is just a part of it. It's a part of the dying physician's opinion. It's not, we're not redoing compensability every time a new body part is issued. With regards to the dying physician, it's essentially a diagnosis. And in this particular case, Dr. Campbell, who the ALJ specifically detailed in his order as being a very thoughtful and thorough witness in this case, she was deposed, extensive cross-examination. Her testimony with regards to causation of the right shoulder never wavered. In her dime report, she opined that the right shoulder was not related to the industrial injury. In her deposition, when she was shown the new MRI, she considered it. She acknowledged that, well, possibly that could be it, but ultimately her opinion remained that the right shoulder need for treatment was not related to the industrial injury. At trial, her testimony remained the same. The right shoulder was not related to the underlying workers' compensation injury. So yes, she was presented at, I mean, when someone has a report and then testifies by deposition and then testifies again and at various stages is presented with new information, it's not unlikely that their answers may not be as consistent as before because they're addressing new information. But I think you'll see that as you read her testimony, especially her cross-examination, when she's questioned by opposing counsel, she remained very consistent with regard to that. And importantly as well, it's corroborated. The authorized treating physician, Dr. Darrell Quick, said the right shoulder was not related. Dr. Carlos Sebring, another expert, right shoulder was not related. Dr. Hugh McPherson, orthopedic surgeon, opined the right shoulder is not related to the industrial injury. In this particular
case, did Dr. Campbell say or concede, as I think Mr. Mullins suggested, that while the injury could be related to overuse of the right shoulder from something related to the industrial injury?
I think she reasonably acknowledged that that was a possibility. But her ultimate opinion...
wasn't her opinion, though.
That was not her opinion. Her ultimate opinion to a reasonable degree of medical probability was that it was not. There are all sorts of possibilities. As anyone who's practiced knows, you can have a doctor on cross-examination. Any reasonable doctor would provide, based on hypotheticals, that, yeah, it's possible. But my opinion is this. And that's what she did in this case. And the ALJ, again, he basically complimented her thoroughness and her conciseness in his order.
Mr. Krug, I do really do understand your position, which is the dying physician was totally consistent, so we have a clear ability to say, was she overcome by clear and convincing evidence? But I want to go back, and this is really just hypothetical, say we agree with Mr. Mullen's position. You can't even tell what her position is, or it's internally inconsistent. If you have that fact, I'm just trying to figure out the line here. Mm-hmm. What would the standard be when you can't? There's nothing to overcome because she's inconsistent. What would you do in that circumstance?
The standard would be, I mean, if you're asking me as the appellate attorney.
And I know you disagree with that.
Quarterbacking.
Please.
It's up first to the administrative law judge to determine what the opinion is. What is the dying physician's opinion?
And what if the ALJ concludes it's inconsistent? I can't tell what it is.
Well, first of all, preface, that's not the situation here.
I understand.
But hypothetically, to be honest, I don't know in that situation. I would imagine the opinion would be overcome by clear and convincing evidence. It would still be a clear and convincing evidence standard. It would just have been overcome. But in this particular case, what's important, and obviously you acknowledged it a second ago, but that the ALJ did in fact render an opinion, like, this is the dying physician's opinion. That was clear, and the evidence supports it.
So thank you. Our thanks to both counsel for the excellent argument.